This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The atrocities in the Soviet Union under the regime of Joseph Stalin have been well documented. During the Great Terror, 1.5 million people were arrested and 700,000 were shot. A new book focuses on the tyranny within Stalin's inner circle. My guest, Simon Sebag Montefiore, is the author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar. Historian Richard Pipes describes it as the first intimate portrait of Stalin. The book is based on recently opened Russian archives containing Stalin's letters as well as those of the members of his inner circle and their families. Montefiore also interviewed the children and grandchildren of the members of the inner circle. I asked him to describe what he found in the Russian archive.
When I arrived to start researching it in about 2000, I arrived at the party archive, the Communist Party archive, and they said, "You're in luck. We're opening half of Stalin's own papers now." So these papers that that I've based the book on are, in fact, the first inner view of how the Kremlin worked, how Stalin's private life worked. So it contains things not only such as the memorandum in which Stalin and Molotov and the others ordered their subordinates to kill about 1 million people by quota, not even by name. For example, that's one side of it, which is the serious documents that show how they actually were responsible for these vast crimes. But the other side of it is intimate papers, Stalin's love letters to his wife, his wife's love letters to him, Molotov's love letters to his wife, and vice versa. Stalin's jokes and drawings, Stalin's notes to his comrades. I mean, one of the things that this book shows is how intimate this little group was.
I'm interested in the memo to kill by quota. How did that memo read?
It reads something like this. We order you to kill enemies of the people, and we order you to kill them by quota. So you in Minneapolis kill 20,000. You in Philadelphia kill 40,000. Los Angeles and Seattle each, you kill 25,000 each. That's it. And it goes through every city and every region of the whole vast Soviet empire. And, of course, the Bolsheviks, the interesting thing about it was that the Bolsheviks were very at home with this idea of killing by quota. But this one I'm talking about in 1937 was really aimed at wiping out a strata of the ruling Bolshevik class, whom Stalin felt had got soft, insubordinate, and insufficiently committed to the cause.
What was going on in Stalin's private life when he wrote this memo?
His wife had committed suicide, and I begin the book with the suicide. Then after that, he'd had an affair with his sister-in-law, in other words, his wife's brother's wife, if you can follow that. And one of the amazing things I found in the archive was actually a photograph, which had never been published before, which is in the book, of Stalin beaming, surrounded by all his favourite women, and at his feet, sitting between his legs, is this woman, Zhenya, grinning up at the camera like the cat that's got the cream. But by 1937, that relationship was also over, and that was a great secret relationship. And in 1937, he began to settle down into secret intimacy with Valechka, who was his housekeeper and maid. And that was a much less equal relationship than any had gone before. But Stalin believed that his private life was dead. He couldn't afford to have anyone really know what was happening in his life. And therefore he'd retired, as it were, to that sort of relationship.
As you mentioned, you start the book with the suicide of his wife. And this was in 1932. She shot herself at the end of a dinner party that the Stalins were giving in their home. How do you think his life was changed by his wife's suicide in 1932?
I don't think the terror was caused by her suicide. And you've got to realize that Stalin was already a mass murderer by then, but so were all the people round him. And certainly it's true to say that the terror was partly formed by Stalin's character, and therefore Stalin's character was certainly partly formed by the suicide of his wife. So it was a contributing factor, and especially towards his attitude to the wives and women of other leaders. And later he would execute and terrorize many of the wives. And that was partly from jealousy that they were happily married and he was now alone, and partly from suspicion that wives could no longer be relied upon.
How many wives in his court do you think he had executed?
Well, I mean, he certainly had two wives very close to, of people very close to him, his secretary and one of his top marshals. They were executed in the most disgusting manner. I mean, one of them was actually kidnapped on the same day that her husband was promoted to Marshal of the Soviet Union. The newly appointed Marshal of the Soviet Union then went to see the head of the secret police, Beria, and said to him, "Where's my wife, do you know?" And she was a very beautiful woman, incidentally. And Beria said, "No, of course not, but why don't we ring up Stalin, see if he knows?" So they rang Stalin, and he said, "I've got Marshal Kulik here with me in the office, and he wants to know where his wife is. Do you know?" And then he put the phone down. He said, "Comrade Stalin doesn't know either." And, of course, all the time, both Stalin and Beria knew that the wife was several floors below them in her cell, waiting to be shot in the back of the head for nothing, for nothing. She was shot just in the back of the head, casually, and she was tried and convicted of nothing. And she was 28 years old and utterly beautiful. And this is the sort of... This is the way that the men around him had to live. This is the way the Bolsheviks had to live.
How do you know for sure that Stalin knew that this woman was a few floors below in a cell about to be executed?
Well, we know that from paperwork in the secret police paperwork and from the memories of people when they were arrested after Stalin's death that he'd ordered it and that Beria and him had arranged it.
How many members of Stalin's court would you say were executed?
Well, I mean, if you think of the sort of the top 100, I mean, the Bolsheviks were a tiny group. You know, when they seized power, there were about 5,000 Bolsheviks, which gives you an idea of the tininess of this little almost fanatical religious sect. The actual ruling section of the party was about 100 people, and by Stalin's time it was, say, 50 people. And that was called the Central Committee. And that he shot the sort of majority of the Central Committee. So, you know, I mean, of his inner circle, of the people he knew very well, you know, he killed over half. And when I mentioned that they killed 1 million people by quota, they also killed 40,000 people by name. And this case, Stalin would be sent albums, as they were called in Russia, which was a little biography of the person, a photo of them, hence the name albums, and, you know, sentenced to death. And Stalin could either put a dash next to it, and that meant preserve them, don't shoot them, keep them in prison, or he could put a note or an insulting comment next to them, like just beat them or, you know, kill them. And he'd often pass it around the Politburo, and they'd all write things on.
Can you give us a sense of what the culture was like in Stalin's inner circle, where people knew that they might be executed by their boss?
I think most of the people believed that they would be all right because surely somehow there was some sort of reason behind it. But those that really knew understood that these people were really being killed for lack of faith. So there was a huge random nature to this. Some people just survived because they were lucky. Some people just, on a whim, Stalin ticked their name. And many people, you know, Stalin said, "Is that guy still alive? I can't remember if we signed his death warrant or not." And was rather disappointed when he found out they'd been shot. So, yes, these people knew that they could be killed at any minute, and they believed that that was right. They believed that the party was always right. The only way to understand them, and I've read all their letters and I've begun to understand this, is that they were religious fanatics who believed it was right to die for the cause, that family and friends were nothing compared with the cause, and the cause was what they called history. So it sounded very scientific. But in actual fact, it was really a religious fanaticism, and that's the only way to understand it.
It's interesting that you describe it as religious fanaticism, because you weren't allowed to practice religion as we know it in the Soviet Union then. But you're saying that the ideology of Stalinism was almost a substitute for extreme religion.
Oh, yes, and almost openly. And they talked about it in that way, too. I mean, the way they talked about themselves was constantly as knights in shining armour who would die for the cause of justice and so on. I mean, you know, they believed that you had to kill a certain number of people now in order to create a deferred paradise later. That was their basic belief. But they saw themselves as a sort of religious military order.
No, Stalin apparently loved the arts, which I suppose goes to show that the arts aren't necessarily ennobling. You say Stalin micromanaged the theater as he dominated cinema, literature, and politics. In what sense did he micromanage the theater?
Well, I mean, just an example from the cinema, if I may, just as part of that answer to that question.
Sure.
I mean, one of the things I found was fascinating was that, you know, not only had he named most of the films and viewed most of the films and worked on their scripts, but I found he was also writing the songs, the lyrics for some of the songs. So he sort of fancied himself as a sort of Rodgers and Hammerstein of Soviet musicals.
You quote a song lyric that Stalin wrote for one of the movies, and it's a cheerful little lyric. This is the English translation of it that you give in your book. A joyful song is easy for the heart. It doesn't bore you ever. And all the villages, small and big, adore the song. Big towns love the tune. A song lyric by Joseph Stalin. Now, you say that Stalin told the writers in the Soviet Union to become engineers of human souls. What did that mean to Stalin?
It meant it doesn't matter how bad a writer you were expected, or how good for that matter. Politics was absolutely supreme. And in this case, these writers were expected to show how life should be, not how life was. And Stalin, engineers of the human soul is a typical Stalin phrase, and I think he coined himself.
And now famous phrase.
Yeah, now a very famous phrase. And he actually had them to this kind of dinner, and he told them that this was what they were to do. And but you know, he understood genius all right. I mean, in one sense, he understood very well. For example, he famously called Boris Pasternak to discuss the famous poet Osip Mandelstam, two of the great poets of his time. And he understood that both of them were geniuses. In fact, he said so. But he regarded them as apolitical geniuses. When Mandelstam made a poem against Stalin, in which he mocked Stalin, then he crossed the line and was moved, as it were, off the precipice, in which he became a nothing in that world. But about Dostoevsky, he famously said, you know, Dostoevsky's a genius. No one understands human psychology like Dostoevsky, said Stalin. And that's why we've banned him completely in the Soviet Union. And that tells you a lot about his attitude. But he read all the time. I mean, I've been through his library. One of the things in this amazing archive is his library. And he annotates everything. He writes, sometimes he writes rather gruesomely, ha, 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 beside things he thought were quite funny. Other times he wrote things like, green steam, exclamation mark. But he read everything. If he was doing politics or statesmanship, he would read up about the person. So when he was negotiating with Hitler, he would read about Bismarck. When he was negotiating with Churchill, he read about Churchill's ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, the great Duke of Marlborough. And he was obsessed with reading, and in fact he loved novels. He'd read his Balzac and his Zola. He loved Zola. And of course, the most surprising ones, he'd read the Forsyte Saga, which all the Politburo read and liked. And of course, they loved Last of the Mohicans. And Stalin, in fact, used to often put on what he called a sort of American Native Indian voice and say, "Hello, hello, pale face, me, big red chief," which, of course, is just extraordinary.
What were his favorite movies?
He loved John Wayne movies. He loved cowboy films. He particularly liked the films directed by John Ford. I think he associated with cowboy films especially because he regarded himself as a special person, a messiah, someone different from other people, someone always travelled alone. He regarded himself almost as without family, without attachments, a man who just could fulfil his historical role. And I think he rather felt himself rather like the cowboy that rides alone into a town, the man with no name almost, you know, who rides into a town and settles its, and gives justice to its people ruthlessly. That's how he saw himself.
Did he think that the movies and books that he loved gave the kind of message that he insisted that the writers and the filmmakers in his world create?
That he loved himself? Oh, no. I mean, he understood. He was an immensely subtle person. He understood perfectly well that that he could love many books and he read everything. But the people shouldn't be allowed to read anything that wasn't politically useful. And that applied to everything, by the way, films and cinema and so on. I mean, he would decide. He believed that history had given him the right to decide these things, and that he loved many books that in the end he banned, you know.
Stalin and Hitler were two of the great monsters of their time, two of the great monsters of the century. Were there interesting things in Stalin's papers about what he thought of Hitler?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's interesting. I mean, Hitler, he did get wrong. He wasn't that he didn't think Hitler would attack him. I mean, he believed that there'd be war by about 1943, but he thought he could put it off by then. And he thought he understood Hitler, and he was wrong. What he thought of Hitler was, I mentioned that he used to read continually about the subjects that were important to him at that time. So he was reading about Bismarck. And Bismarck always said, Germany will never go to war, should never go to war on two fronts. And, you know, he believed that Hitler was a great power politician, a real politician like himself, who wouldn't do anything so foolish. And in fact, he used to say quite often, gosh, you know, does Hitler really think that Russia is a country like, you know, England or France or Poland that you can just take like that? He said, you know, doesn't he realise we're five times bigger than that and we have such resources? He couldn't believe Hitler would be so stupid as to attack him. And the most revealing thing, I found this out in Georgia. I mean, I went down to Georgia a lot and found many other new materials apart from the archives. But one of the things I found there was this fascinating just nugget of history where Stalin, for the only time in his career, talked about the mistake he'd made in Hitler. And he said, you know, my mistake was to believe that he was someone like myself. And what he meant was that he thought Hitler was a normal politician. In fact, Hitler himself described himself as a sleepwalker, a gambler. Stalin wasn't like that in international affairs. He was actually very cautious, and so that's what he got wrong.
Do you think Stalin saw any similarities between himself and Hitler as people who were mass murderers and who had this ideology that ruled everything in their lives?
Yes and no. He had contempt for Nazism because Nazism actually was much more, was really the worship of power and the glamour of power. So he regarded that as very crass, while Marxism and Leninism was this international ideal to improve humanity. So he regarded that as much superior. But he did regard Hitler as someone who, like himself, was a ruthless and brilliant statesman and a man who could get things done. And we know, for example, that when Hitler killed all his opponents in 1934 in the Night of the Long Knives, Stalin said to his rather surprised companions, he said, that's a clever man, that Hitler. He knows how to get things done and get rid of his people and his enemies. And, of course, that was a lesson that Stalin took to heart.
I doubt Stalin would have objected to Hitler's fear and hatred of the Jews and his attempts to exterminate all of them.
I don't know. I don't think Stalin necessarily wanted to exterminate the Jews. He always was very suspicious of the Jews because, various reasons. One was that, you know, he wanted everyone to belong, and he was actually a sort of nationalist in many ways, a Russian nationalist. Jews didn't belong, didn't have loyalty to only one source of authority. So that was one reason. Another reason was that Stalin's opponents were overwhelmingly Jewish intellectuals, like Trotsky, the best example. But one often forgets that right up until Stalin's death, some of his closest colleagues were Jews. His whole secretariat virtually was Jewish. But after the war, then Stalin became a real anti-Semite, a real frenzied anti-Semite. And the reason for this was that Israel was founded. He began to see that many of the people around him, the wives, for example, Molotov's wife, had a dual fidelity, partly to Marxism, Leninism and Soviet Russia, but partly to Israel too. And he became very suspicious of this. And when Israel turned out to be an American ally, he began to see this as a useful political tool, and that Jews were all around him. And he could wipe out people near him, like Molotov, by using it. He could also rally the Soviet Union again by using this internal enemy. And he did become a frenzied anti-Semite then.
Did Stalin ever write in his letters or in other papers that you've read how he hoped history would remember him?
Not specifically, but it was clear that how he saw himself. I mean, he wanted people to remember him as a pitiless, brutal, but enormously successful man who created Marxism, Leninism in the Soviet Empire, and from Berlin to Mongolia, who used his military talents as a warlord to win the war against Hitler, a man who had created a new form of arts, a new form of cinema. That was how he wanted to remember it, and as a czar, as the most powerful czar the Russian people ever had. So he was always these two things. On one hand, Marxism, Leninism, this idealism. On the other hand, great power politics and history.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Simon Sebag Montefiore is the author of Stalin, The Court of the Red Tsar.